listening to Miller and Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network. And now, here's Mark Miller and David Moulton.
Top of the morning to you, Miller and Moulton, the Florida Sports Network. Thanks so much for being with us on this Monday after Mother's Day weekend. Nice little sports weekend. Thank you very much. A lot of home cooking in the playoffs, however. Hockey and NBA, a lot of home cooking. I don't know what to make of it.
Making for a great first round of the NHL and second round of the NBA playoffs.
So, how concerned should we be about our Florida Panthers there?
Really concerned. They can end all of it tonight with a decisive win, with any type of a win. But they, to me, have not looked like the best team in this series at all.
The Caps gave them a lesson in what the playoffs was all about on Saturday.
They really did.
Ovechkin and the boys, who many of them have been there before, even though they haven't had any playoff success since they won the Cup, which is 4 years ago now. But they tapped the Florida Panthers on the shoulder and said, this is what the playoffs are all about, and you're not going to like it, by the way.
Well, and the Florida Panthers were not a great, not as great of a regular season team as their President's Trophy claimed that they were.
We tried to point out there were a couple of teams, if you looked closely at their point totals, they were not as impressive as it looked. The Panthers, I believe, were 7th or 8th in the league in regulation wins. No team had more points via the 3-on-3 overtime or in a shootout than the Florida Panthers did this year. They were like 4th in the East and 7th or 8th overall in the league in regulation 60-minute wins. And basically, in the silliness that is how we decide the end of games in the regular season, the Panthers excelled. Not a lot of silliness in the NHL playoffs.
No. We're going to play 5-on-5 until we get a winner. And they haven't even dealt with that yet.
And when you get a power play at a key time, you better score. Because the game and maybe the series shifted at the end of the first period of Game 3. Panthers are up 1-0. They're playing a good period. They got the better of the play. They got a power play. Okay, boys, make it 2-0. Going into the room. Caps kill the penalty. Draw penalty at the end of the PK. Get a face-off deep in the zone. Bada bing, bada boom, ends up in the back of the net. It's 1-1 going to the room. Entire day was different after that.
And the Washington Capitals don't play the third period in the postseason the way teams play the third period in the regular season. The Florida Panthers were remarkable during the regular season in coming back in games. Yep. Nobody had ever done what the Panthers had done in the third period. They were terrific. David and I marveled many a time getting here in the morning going, I'll be damned.
Came back again.
They came back again. And it wasn't just coming back from 1-goal deficits. They came back from 2- and 3-goal deficits. But in the postseason, teams tighten up. They're not going to give that long stretch pass. They're going to make sure guys are back. And right now, the Panthers need to figure out the Washington Capitals.
And they're going to have to win tough, hard-nosed, 5-on-5 hockey.
And when they get power plays, they have to score.
And all the pressure's on them. And the pressure's never been on them before. Like when they played the Lightning last year, Panthers may have had home ice in the series. We all laughed. I mean, the Lightning were clearly the favorites. They're defending Stanley Cup champions. And this is where, you know, they try to block it out. But, hey, guess what? Never won a playoff series before when losing Game 1. What happened Game 1, Mark?
They lost.
And they blew a third-period lead. What hadn't they done all year?
Well, they really not in regulation, not blown one.
39-0-1 was their record when leading after two. What haven't they done since 1996?
Won a playoff series.
That's right. You think everybody in that room knows that?
I'm pretty sure that they do.
I think by now they do. Yeah.
They got an interim head coach that would really like the job.
Well, and let me tell you, here's a guy who was getting Coach of the Year votes a week ago and now might be a week away from the unemployment line.
That's what the playoffs will do to you.
There you go. And you got a couple of old-timers. May have heard of them. Sidney Crosby. Alex Ovechkin. Turning back the clock a little bit here. It's the playoffs. They kind of know what to do. They're pretty good, you know, still.
You know, there was a little scrum late in game three, and Ovechkin was in it. And one of the Panther players was kind of chirping, and he looked over to Ovechkin, and I'm not sure what he said, but I think he wanted to call him an old man and just said, yeah, I probably better not.
I got to play against this guy for another week.
Because the old gray-haired guy that looks like he'd be holding a sign saying, we'll work for food, is still getting it done out there.
Is a tank with a shot, is what he is. So, there you go. Hey, Lightning responded last night. Champs, backs against the wall, that whole thing. I thought, actually, they played okay in Game 3. I thought Anderson was every bit the goalie, you know, that the Lightning had. So, I thought to myself, you know, if they keep playing like this, he's not gonna play like this three more times. He's just not. And sure enough, you know, I mean, you got to feel pretty good if you're the Lightning, right? I mean, come on, you're the Lightning, they're the Leafs. You got the best goalie in the world, they don't.
On that alone, you should feel good. But Toronto has played well.
They have. And they are skilled, man. They are skilled. Both these teams can score quickly.
Waiting to see a great game in this series.
You know what? Waiting to see some great games in the NHL playoffs.
Outside of Pittsburgh and the Rangers, which has been a good series, you've had to watch some out west games late to get close hockey games.
So, the Lightning, they held up their end of the deal last night, even the series at 2. Can the Panthers do it tonight? Not that this organization needs it or anything. I mean, it barely has a fan base. It's worked really hard for the last year and a half to put an exciting team together, actually get people going to their games. Miami Dolphins and Miami Heat players are going to their games.
I don't know if they're being paid to go to their games, but they're going to their games.
They're going anyway. Two, 3 years ago, you couldn't pay them enough money to go to the games.
I mean, Kodak Black is going to games.
See? But if they lose to the Caps, I mean,
nobody's going.
After having the best regular season in the league, what can you do next regular season that people won't go, yeah, whatever, I'll be seeing the playoffs.
And what a town to do that in.
Totally.
What a town to give them regular season greatness only to sputter in the postseason.
You know, we can ignore you for the full year next year. Jump on board in the second round of the playoffs.
That's right.
If you make it. So, Panthers Caps tonight.
But I will say, Felipe, your Heat that you go the time on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being holy blank, I'm scared to death concerned, and 1 being no worries, we've got this covered. Where are you right now?
Home court advantage.
It's not an answer on a scale of one to ten.
That answers my question.
No, it doesn't.
A number. So we need a number.
So okay. A one. You think this series is over, Miami's got it. You're that confident
right.
in home court advantage that you give it a one. That's what you're telling me.
You have zero concern. I'll give it a four.
Okay. Not very concerned. So basically, you think the Heat's going to be Heat in seven. It's going to be a home court series.
Miami's got no answer for Joel Embiid. That's it.
Which is funny because they've got this guy called Bam Adebayo, and they were supposed to have a little bit of an answer.
Bam can't do anything about Joel.
Well,
yeah. Not a lot of people can do anything about Joel.
You're right.
The point is that James Harden had the James Harden game, and if he can keep having the James Harden games, then they're in trouble.
But right now you think the Heat will win at home, so worst-case scenario, seven-game series.
Yes, both teams are very good at home.
116-108 Sixers last night. The classic case of the role players playing much better at home than on the road has played out in the first four games of this series. Now, the one series is 2-2, and the Lightning are 2-2, and the Panthers are down 2-1. But I almost feel like asking as a poll question, which Florida team are you most worried about?
And I think the Panthers would win.
I don't know if enough people care enough about the Panthers to vote for them, though.
Then there's that.
Right. You know, we could just, if we take the Panthers out, which team, you know.
2-2?
2-2. Heat or Lightning, which one are you more concerned about? Heat have home court. Lightning don't have home ice, but they're the Lightning. They deserve the benefit of the doubt. They've earned it.
I'd be more concerned with the Lightning out of the two of them.
I'm more concerned about the Heat.
Real quick.
Vasilevsky's still the Lightning goalie, right?
He is.
Okay, good.
You mentioned that Game 3 and Game 4, the Heat hit 7 threes in both games.
Right.
Duncan Robinson played 1 minute in both those games. He's being paid $90 million or over 3 years. 1 minute. There's got to be something going on within the locker room that, of course, the Miami Heat will never publicize. What is going on?
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out in Game 5, because if he doesn't play in Game 5, then we've got issues.
There's problems. Like, this better not keep up or else he's gone.
Butler with 40 last night, and the Heat lost. They had never had a player score 40 in a playoff game and lose before. They were 13-0 till last night. Jimmy Butler was damn good last night.
Yes, he was, but not good enough to get to the victory.
So you figure out which one you want to go with. You want to add the Panthers to the Heat and the Lightning, two franchises with gravitas, with credibility that have won championships, and then there's the Panthers, or... You know, do you want to just have it, a poll question, with the two franchises that have won championships, that have gravitas, that have credibility, that are both 2-2? It's up to you.
You make a dadgum good point about the Panthers. I mean, you really do, David. When you put the Panthers on a poll question, people have to go,
what?
Why are the Pitt Panthers on the poll question?
Why is he talking about the Carolina Panthers? It's not football season. When we come back, we will talk football, however. Kurt Becker's going to join us in about, I don't know, 25 minutes. We're going to talk about the craziest derby arguably ever. But when we come back, I got a football stat for you.
Stat of the day? Stat of the day?
Could be.
Wow.
And we're going off the reservation for the stat.
That must mean the USFL. Can't wait for this.
It doesn't. It's NFL, Miller and Moulton, Florida Sports Network.
You're listening to Miller and Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network.
21 minutes after the hour, Miller and Moulton, Florida Sports Network. Our buddy Kurt Becker will join us a little more than 15 minutes' time to talk about the most unlikeliest of Kentucky Derbies ever. 80-1! We will reference Rich Strike and the 2022 Kentucky Derby, probably marked for the rest of our careers.
Something else, and more than just obviously the long shot, but for those of us that pay a little bit of attention to horse racing, what a brilliant ride.
Yes. From an unknown jockey, basically.
Unknown jockey, unknown trainer, unknown owner, unknown everybody. Loved the question. You didn't really think you could do this. And the owner, you saw his eyes
right
as the question's being asked. And he just said, we don't put a horse in a race unless we think we can win. And whether anybody else believed him, he believed himself. You could tell the facial expression when the question came out. It was almost looking at the reporter saying, No. It's not how this business works.
Well, I believe it is $50,000, the entry fee into the Derby. So when they line up 20 horses, that's $1 million.
Right.
I mean,
you know. Something for the effort?
I understand that in the grand scheme of big-time racing, $50,000 is not considered a lot of money. But hell, you could have had the horse 8 months earlier for a $30,000 claim. Had never raced in a race with a purse of more than $100,000 before.
Crazy.
We'll talk to Kurt Becker about it in a little more than 15 minutes' time. All right. You may make fun of me here.
No.
But I'm man enough, I'm tough enough, I can handle it. You tell me if this means anything to you. We don't know. We'll know Thursday night, you know, who's playing who when.
I know.
And where. The new phone books are here. The new phone books are here. That's the NFL schedule release, Thursday night, 8 o'clock. Although there's going to be drips and drabs. Apparently Joe and Troy are on Good Morning America this morning. I don't know. They're announcing one game. Don't know what it is. I have no idea. Don't know if it's their first game.
They're not leaking it to you?
No. Trust me, Bill, Ed, and I know nothing. Absolutely nothing. We just know the insignia on the top left-hand part of the check is going to change. So, but everybody knows, okay, who you're playing, and you at least know where you're playing them, home or away. Do you know the Pittsburgh Steelers never leave the Eastern time zone for the entire season?
One of those years that everything works out, huh?
They are traveling only 6,442 miles. And they are not leaving, okay, which I don't understand. Well, I mean, they don't even go right to, like, Nashville. You know, just nothing. Meanwhile, the Seattle Seahawks are going to be in 34 different time zones when they travel, and they're flying just under 30,000 miles. Now, granted, they got one of those international games. You know, they got a London game. But obviously, and this happens a lot, the teams in the Western divisions, they oftentimes are the ones that have the most travel. It seems as if really there's just no way around it. Although, you know, Jacksonville with an international game actually has the third most miles that they're traveling this year, at over 25,000. The Dolphins are fourth most. Dolphins, they don't have an international game, do they? I don't think they do this year. You know, the Saints, the Bucks, who have a Germany game, 26 time zones, nearly 24,000 miles. In this day and age, do you think that this means anything?
No. I don't.
So the advantage in travel that the Steelers...
If the Pittsburgh Steelers had a quarterback, David, then this would be a great stat.
Okay, with that in mind, second fewest miles traveled, Lions.
If the Lions had a quarterback.
All right. Third fewest miles traveled, Baltimore. Only two time zones for the Ravens also. 9,500 travel miles. Remember, AFC has the extra road game this year, right?
Yes, they do.
The Browns, two time zones. A little less than 10,000 miles they will travel. The Bengals, sixth fewest, four time zones, a little less than 11,000. So, you know, that, just throwing it out there. I mean, it is interesting. Philly and Washington don't have a ton of miles that they are flying. The Giants, because they play an international game, they're actually in the top 25% of the league in terms of travel miles. The time zones interest me. I will say, like, when I travel, you know, just getting used to the time zone, sometimes it can throw me off.
Mountain time zone, most underrated time zone in the United States of America.
It is tremendous. The Denver Broncos games are outstanding.
Means those 4 o'clock games are 2.
Right.
Monday night football.
6.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 2 o'clock game, you can actually get a flight out. You can do the game race to the airport and you can get out. Nope, it's wonderful. So this stat doesn't do anything for you, huh?
No, I find it to be very interesting. I don't think it matters the way it once did. Everybody's traveling on private planes. Travel is not what it used to be. So I don't think it matters the way it once did.
And we've, at length, the last couple years, detailed how road teams the last 3 years have won almost the same number of games as home teams. And that's how little there is of a home field advantage now.
It used to be 3 points in Vegas. What's it, a half point now?
A point and a half, I believe. It got narrowed down to a point and a half this year. So, and that's noteworthy. But, all right. I mean, that's all I got.
No,
The Steelers not leaving the Eastern time zone, though, I find that amazing.
I do like that.
So, obviously, if you're in the AFC North this year, you're not playing either of the Western divisions.
No.
So, you're only, although, and they must get.
It's going to the Cowboys or going to the Saints. Like, the Steelers have those teams at home.
Right. Well, yeah, because that would be going to the central time zone.
Right.
They don't even do that. So they just get the one team, I'm assuming, from the AFC West, and that team must come to them.
And that's the Raiders, who the Steelers have this year.
Right, and they come to Pittsburgh. I mean, they're traveling 6,442 miles, for goodness sakes, Mark. That's like one trip to L.A. and back, basically.
They have divisional road games, which you know. The rest of them are the Falcons, the Bills, the Panthers, Miami, their longest road trip, Indianapolis, and the Philadelphia Eagles.
I mean, they're going to be flying on Saturdays. The trips are so short.
Their longest trip is to Miami.
I mean, they don't have to have a Friday after practice, you know, let's head to the airport and let's fly in Friday night deal. Mark, they could have home walkthroughs and travel to some of these games if they want, for goodness sakes. Hell, just to spice things up, they may bust their way to Philly just to be different. So, that's all. That's all I got. Seahawks travel nearly 30,000 miles, 34 time zones. The Steelers, 6,400 miles, zero time zones. Zero.
Don't even have to wind the watch this year.
Nope. Miller and Moulton. Kurt Becker, Horse Racing Radio Network. A historic Kentucky Derby. We will get his educated perspective on it.
In fact, Rich Strike, a farther trip than the Steelers will have to make this entire season.
Miller and Moulton, thanks for listening. Florida Sports Network.
Welcome back to Miller and Moulton, only on the Florida Sports Network.
Bird, it is Crown Pride battling with Messier. They're stride for stride. Epicenter and Zozo's in behind them. Cyberknife swings up to the outside. Sandon gets the rail run, and they're into the stretch. Then it's Messier, Crown Pride, then Epicenter is coming up on the outside. Epicenter has taken the lead as they arrive into the final furlong. Sandon is coming after him. Epicenter and Sandon, these two, stride for stride. Simplification down the outside is next. They're coming down to the wire. Epicenter, Sandon, Rich Strike is coming up on the inside. Oh my goodness, the longest shot has won the Kentucky Derby. Rich Strike has done it in a stunning, unbelievable upset.
That was early Saturday evening, a historic Kentucky Derby. Rich Strike at 80-1 coming from the way outside to start and way back when they get to the stretch to win the Kentucky Derby. Kurt Becker of the Horse Racing Radio Network is kind enough to join us now. Kurt, it's David and Mark once again. How are you?
Good. Good to be back on to talk a little post-Kentucky Derby.
You can follow Kurt on Twitter at Becker Trackside.
Well, Kurt, I don't even know where to start with this, but just give us the little bit of the background of how Rich Strike even gets into the race.
I'll put it this way. If you want some perspective on how shocking the outcome was, I've got a colleague who works with me at Keeneland Race Course in Lexington, Kentucky, and he's nearly 70 years old. He's been in the business essentially his whole life. And right after the race, that was the question he had. He texted me and he said, "Okay, how did Rich Strike even qualify? Where did he score his points?" And I had to go back and look because I don't know. And you go back and you look, and the horse had spent the winter at Turfway Park in the Cincinnati area, and he had been fourth in the John Battaglia Memorial. He had been third, I believe, in the Jeff Ruby Stakes, which are not really traditional Kentucky Derby prep races, but it was enough points to get him into the gate. And of course, the key was a day before the race when Dwayne Lucas announced he was scratching Ethereal Road. So look at Dwayne Lucas. Talk about a guy that had an impact on the weekend. Dwayne trains the winner of the Kentucky Oaks on Friday and ends up indirectly having a role on Saturday when he scratched Ethereal Road and paved the way for Rich Strike to draw into the Kentucky Derby, and Rich Strike made the most of it.
Kurt, has there ever been a horse that was not in the field Friday morning win the Derby?
No. This is a first. Churchill went to the also eligible system when they went to the point system, which was 2013. I think there have been a horse or two that have drawn into the race late in the week. A horse that comes to mind that didn't draw into the main body of the field until late was Golden Soul back in 2013, but I think he was already programmed somewhere in within those 20 starters by the time they drew post positions, and he was runner up. But this was just absolutely something that caught a lot of us by surprise,
including I think the race announcer who may have caught Rich Strike a little after the rest of us did. All right, just the trip that this horse took in this race. It looked like a marvelous job by the jockey. You know, we're all in a little bit of awe that it happened, but when you watched the race again, Kurt, how marveled were you at the job that his jockey did?
Just incredible. And I'll put it this way. People that don't follow horse racing, including people in other sports, have been commenting on social media. I do some work with Motor Racing Network covering NASCAR, and I've been shocked. I mean, there have been NASCAR Cup Series drivers and crew chiefs talking about the job that this jockey did. Sonny Leone is the jockey, and somebody pointed out, I mean, here's a guy that really has toiled in obscurity. He tends to ride at tracks that don't get a lot of publicity. He's not a guy that rides in a lot of grade one races, much less triple crown races. And it was remarkable. I don't care what he did. It was the right decision. He went right when he had to go to the right. He went left when he had to go to the left. And he rode that horse with a lot of confidence. And it was a magnificent ride. Some people are comparing it to Calvin Burrell on that rail skimming ride with Mind That Bird. But this to me is even more impressive. I mean, Calvin knew Churchill Downs and just shot up the rail. Great ride. It was fine. But this horse with Sonny Leone, I mean, Sonny had never been in this kind of a circumstance. The biggest stage of the sport weaves through all that traffic and wins.
We're talking with Kurt Becker, Horse Racing Radio Network, about the remarkable, historic Kentucky Derby, in which 80-1 Rich Strike, the second biggest underdog to ever win. I think 100 plus years ago, there was a 90-something-to-1 horse that won the Derby. So certainly in modern racing, the biggest upset that we have seen, of course, in horse racing's biggest race. Kurt, much was made after the race about the pace was blistering, because it did look at the end as if Rich Strike, you know, had a jet-propelled engine behind it in passing the other horses. Do you think it was a case of most of the field ran itself into the ground and this jockey and this horse didn't?
I think that was a big, big factor. It had been a long time, 8 or 9 years, since we saw an opening quarter in 21 seconds and change and an opening half mile in 45 seconds and change. And, I mean, to give listeners some perspective, I think in recent years we've usually seen an opening quarter that's closer to 24 seconds and an opening half mile that's closer to 48 seconds. So that did make a big difference. And I think if you go back and if you pull up the chart of the race, it seems like the top 7 or 8 finishers were all horses that came from off the pace and were nowhere to be found in the top 5 in that early portion of the event. And you know, if you're Steve Asmussen, the trainer of Epicenter, who ends up the runner up, I mean, poor Steve Asmussen, you're 0-for-23 going into the race. You're the winningest trainer in the history of the sport. You're trying to finally win that elusive Derby. And a furlong from home, you look like you've got it in the bag, and here comes an 80-to-1 shot. Poor Steve. I mean, I just can't imagine. He's got to feel like at this point, man, when is this ever going to happen to finally win the Derby? He just, for whatever reason, it just never seems to work out. But just incredible in the outcome.
Kurt, why do we have all the speed at the front? There was a lot of talk of because we've run so many of these races where you get to the front and you stay at the front. Were all of these trainers, jockeys, and horses convinced it was going to be another race like the last 10 and that getting to the front was the most important part?
I think a big factor was the horse that did go right to the front out of the gate, Summer Is Tomorrow. That horse came out of the United Arab Emirates Derby over in the Middle East. And he was a horse that looked on paper like he really had to have the lead. And I think what happened, this was a year where you had, besides him, you had maybe 6 or 7 other horses that weren't necessarily speedballs, but were horses that needed to be or wanted to be right close to the pace. And I think what happened is you ended up with several jockeys who thought, okay, this horse up front is setting such a fast pace. I've got to stay close because if I don't, the horse I'm on is going to get swallowed up in traffic. And if that happens, a lot of those types of horses simply they get to the point where they don't want to run. If other horses go past them early, they get upset. They throw in the towel, so to speak. They've got to be on or near the lead. And I think Summer Is Tomorrow was the key. He set the fast pace. And probably 5 or 6 other horses and jockeys were in a position where the jocks thought, I've got to stay up on this pace. I can't get swallowed up in the field behind him. And it just turned out to be just an incredibly fast pace.
You know, Kurt, if this horse was even 30-to-1, his trainer and his owner get probably lengthy features by NBC, because for those of us who knew nothing about them, we find out that the owner had kind of gone, you know, darn near belly up in the oil and gas industry at one point in time. And the trainer, a horrific fire 6 years ago, lost almost all his horses, his whole life in racing, burnt up. I mean, the more you found out about the people behind the horse, the more you thought, well, this is like the damn near greatest racing story I've ever heard.
It really produced an incredible storyline from all the perspectives that you just mentioned. And, you know, one of the things that I have heard, my hometown is in central Illinois. It's a town of 2,400 people. It's a rural agricultural community. And I had a guy yesterday who told me, he said, nothing against the people who normally win the race. But he said, I just don't identify with blue-blooded multimillionaires. He said, I watch the race every year, and he said, I always enjoy watching the horses. But he said, this is the first time in a long time that I've been able to really identify with the connections of the horse. And it's so important. And these things have got to happen. If the Derby comes down every single year, if it just comes down to who spends the most money, who spends the most millions of dollars in the auction ring buying the highest price, best bred horse, then pretty soon we all just need to pack it in and forget it. That outcome is exactly what keeps people interested. It's what gives people hope, and that's why this story is resonating with so many people, and it's still a hot topic of conversation nearly 48 hours later.
All right. Typically, when we get a Derby winner, the way things have changed, no one sends their horse to the Preakness. But because so many good horses did not get a win in the Derby, and we're right there for the Derby, and obviously the Preakness being a little bit shorter, does this change any strategy with an 80-1 horse winning the Derby of who will send their horse to the Preakness?
It does, because already the folks at Pimlico Racecourse in Baltimore, where the Preakness will be run in a couple of weeks, they are putting out a list of probable entrants for the race based on their conversations since the Derby ended on Saturday evening. And I'm seeing right now a list of 15 or 16 horses that are potential candidates to land in the starting gate for the Preakness, which, don't forget, the Preakness is a smaller gate. They might end up with an overflow field, because if memory serves, the maximum field size in the Preakness is 14 as opposed to the 20 that we just saw in the Derby. And guys, that's another thing. Absolutely, when you get an 80-1 shot that wins the opening leg of the Triple Crown, typically those type of horses really struggle to come back and win the next race or any of the other two races, the Preakness or the Belmont. Now, who knows? I mean, this horse already has pulled a shocker that hardly any of us saw coming. But absolutely, it leaves the door wide open, and it makes people think, all right, look, that was a fluke. No way this horse is going to come back in 2 weeks and pull another one. But you never know.
Kurt, 10 seconds. You ever seen anything like this?
No, I have not. Simply incredible. It's not at that level, and I don't know if I've seen something like that at any level in the game. Incredible.
Kurt, thanks for making time for us once again, and we'll catch up in about 10 days leading up to the Preakness.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Kurt Becker, Horse Racing Radio Network. You can follow him on Twitter at Becker Trackside. Becker Trackside. Kurt Becker joining us once again here on Miller and Moulton.
Phenomenal.
Rich Strike was not going to run the Preakness. I mean, the owner said that afterwards. Was not going to run the Preakness. Was going to run the Belmont, though. They thought the Belmont was the best race, but was not going to run the Preakness. My guess is it's going to run the Preakness.
You're going to run the Preakness now.
But it could be one of the rare times where the Derby winner is not the favorite.
I don't think he will be.
I don't even know if he'll be top three, top four.
What do you do if your Epicenter is Andon, who are right there? Typically, they're not running these horses if they don't win and there's not a chance for the Triple Crown.
It's awesome. Just 80-1. I mean, we will reference this horse in long shots from now until whenever. Miller and Moulton, thanks for being with us. Florida Sports Network.